I'm Christopher Lydon at the piano bench in the music studio just outside Boston of Yehudi Weiner. He's a Grammy finalist composer, a Pulitzer Prize winner, who is also a high-performance pianist. It must be true, Yehudi, that you play the piano better than anybody who composes as well as you do, and probably vice versa.
I'm not so sure about that.
But this is the Benjamin Britten or the Leonard Bernstein combination of big skills, or the Rachmaninoff combination, or Clara Schumann, going back, of course, to Beethoven and Mozart. We're talking with Yehudi Weiner about A Life in Music on Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it, about arts and ideas from the Watson Institute at Brown University. Yehudi, thank you for letting us in. The privilege and the fun is to get you at the piano, hands on the keys. Go back to where you were in your Bach exercises. What does that do for a man?
It gives him the feeling that he's in touch with the greatest possible art, spirit, physical, mental, spiritual, integrated, and above all, healthy. Bach was really the greatest artist and possibly the greatest specimen of human being and thinker who ever was conceived on earth.
Amen. You remind me of that Lewis Thomas line that, you know, if we were sending one message to another planet, another galaxy, we'd send the well-tempered clavier. But then he said, but that would be bragging.
That would be bragging. It's one of my favorite quotes.
Do you ever play your own music at the piano just for fun? Would you give us a taste?
Okay, I will. But I never play it by memory. I don't remember my own music, or I don't spend the time to memorize it. You have to understand, Chris, that I've been writing music since I was, somehow putting music together since I was 5 years old. That means 75 years of pieces. The styles have changed, the times have changed, my expectations and craft have changed. I would hardly know where to begin. Here's a minor composition. I say minor because it came out of a rather silly situation of writing a piece for Bob Levin's class. He was throwing a party, and I couldn't go to the party, and I asked Bob what he was going to do, and he said he was going to cook some pasta and make a very good pasta sauce with fragrance and unctuousness. And I
said, the Bob Levin, Mozart's nephew, the guy who presumes to finish the unfinished Mozart.
The wonderful and wondrous Robert Levin. And so I couldn't go to the party, and instead those words, fragrance and unctuousness, which just popped out of Bob's mouth, stuck in mind. And I wrote this stupid little piece, which has a kind of a romantic fragrance and possibly is somewhat unctuous as well, and gave it to him. Not particularly characteristic of the music I write in general.
Thank you. Hmm. Did we resolve that?
No. No, the sauce was not quite finished.
Yehudi Weiner, you're an approachable guy with a musical sound I recognize, and again, I find very, very beautiful. But you give us the opening, the courage to ask where so-called serious or composed music comes from these days. And I'd love you just to speak for yourself. Where did that come from?
This little piece, which I don't put on a very high plateau in my own work, is a kind of informal billet doux, if you'd like, just a little feuilleton. And it's in a almost completely recognizable vernacular style. You know, it could be adapted as far as the harmonic conduct is concerned, it could be adapted to a pop song of the Bing Crosby or Frank Sinatra era, or it could relate to some of the French bistro chansons that one would find with Edith Piaf and others. Where did the idea come from? Well, remember the text were those two magic words, fragrance and unctuousness. Fragrance and unctuousness, unctuousness. Fragrance and unctuousness, fragrance and unctuousness, and fragrance and unctuousness. So, you know, this reminds me of that marvelous little saying of Picasso's that there are vitamins in the garbage.
Can I just say, I hear something of Victor Young, or one of those 30s, 40s love songs.
I guess so. But the only problem with the reference to Victor Young is that I don't know any of his music.
Oh, sure you
But
do.
That would be, well, perhaps it's in the air.
My Foolish Heart, for example.
My what?
My Foolish
Heart.
Okay,
all right. But of course, you know, if you identify that, you really confirm the truth about my musical era and about my musical sensibility, which is never resisting anything that comes through my ears from the earliest time of my life to the present. It doesn't get memorized, but somehow it registers in the brain and has an effect. And while there are many schools of thought which really deal with ideology or a particular technique or, a program largely of exclusion, resulting in what people talk about as a pure style or something utterly new and never having existed under the face of the sun. My own voyage through music has been one of acquisition and acceptance, even of all kinds. I've never had an ideological idea. I never joined any of the camps, I must say. There was a time, I think, when I was certainly powerfully influenced by the models of my youth, Bartok, and certainly then Hindemith was a passion.
And a teacher, right?
And a teacher.
But there was your father before that.
No, my father was never my teacher. He really avoided completely, but my father was there for sure.
And his sound was there, and his music was there.
His sound and his music was around the house, and certainly left that, plus the music that he was either performing or teaching. A great deal of music which was inundated with Jewish melos, particularly from music of the Pale, from the ghettos, from Eastern Europe, and choral music, vocal music above all. But my father refused to ever be my teacher, and he held himself aloof from the training. I was put into the hands of different teachers, but he stayed out of it.
You had to go back to the notion that a composer's music is in some fashion, it's not a compilation, but it's some sort of compost heap of every sound he's ever heard.
I think
and
so.
Absorbed.
What I can do in this respect is even demonstrate to some extent a music that was from a time when I was really using models very consciously in trying to learn how music went, how it goes. I had to try to model my music on certain models. And I'll play you, for example, a movement from a piano partita I wrote in 1952. I was 23. I was going to Harvard for a year, and I took a course with Randall Thompson here at Harvard in the music of Handel. Now, it begins, let's say, with something that's fairly recognizable from a Baroque point of view. Very Stravinskian. Yes, Stravinsky was practicing this kind of appropriation, this kind of theft, this banditry. And very soon, it begins to depart as if out of phase, out of focus, out of mind, into a different kind of, it evolves into a different kind of expression, which is at once more dissonant, more disjunct, more violent. There's a certain amount of aggression here. You find no aggression ever in Handel or Bach's music. You find energy, you find momentum, but you do not find a kind of personal, almost anger and aggression. Occasionally you'll find a chorus in Bach which is supposed to describe an unruly mass or a rage in the St. John Passion and the St. Matthew Passion sometimes. But this becomes quite different and suddenly lifts it out of the consciousness. You somehow remove yourself from the consciousness of the origin. The origin is indeed 18th century, is indeed organized and level and restrained. This is unrestrained in many ways. Also, there's no question that underlying all of this is the influence of the steady beat of the jazz band.
I was going to say.
Yeah, it's right there. And these figures are jazz figures. So we're plunging ahead. And in 1963, I just began to teach at Yale. I was teaching a class and it was supposed to be contemporary techniques. And I set an assignment to write a piece which somehow bore some relation to Stravinsky's symphonies of wind instruments. So I decided then that it wasn't really very good teaching for me to make an assignment for the students and not to try to do the same thing myself. And this is what came out. Thank you. it's clear that that's in another world from the neoclassic or the neo-baroque. So you find a rather mellifluous texture, for example, very pleasant, even though the chords are not particularly consonant. Those sorts of things. But even in that, you would be... That's the melodic part at the heart of that. And that returns very shortly after this peculiar, mysterious intrusion. An echo of the beginning, you know, but... seen now in a kind of stratospheric purification, if you like.
Can I ask an idiotic question? Do you write that Yehudi between hands and ear, or do you write it with eye and pencil
hands
and paper?
Hands and ear. Hands, ear, and pencil. And instrument.
Okay.
And you know, I work at the piano. The model for me is the indescribable sensuous as well as the intellectual joy of dealing with Bach or Mozart. Other composers too, of course, but they above all, where every moment at whatever level of struggle to master the problems always has a satisfaction, always is nourishing. Mm. And I find that if I do this, if I don't do it at the instrument and test it and feel how durable it is, how much I can stand repeating something without finding it exhausting or boring, then I think I have achieved something. I've found something. I've stumbled on some material that's worthwhile. Years later, after writing those early fantasies, I would write something that seems as conservative and referential as this. This piece came out of the sonority of a particular piano. I was working at the American Academy in Rome. And the Steinway I had to work on just had a particular resonance, and these chords just sang. Mm. Now, immediately after that came a piece which was quite the opposite. And if that one was rather static, This one was rather hysterically full of movement. That's just a sample of, you know, the different kind of dynamic. And at the same time, at the same time as that piece was being written, or within a week or so, I was again indulging in the vernacular. So there's no straight line, the vernacular being... playing it like a pig, but I, you know, the pieces are hard and I don't practice them. But also, and then a piece that I wrote very shortly around the same time, a piece which I dedicated to our beloved Robert Levin, and it's called Straccio Vecchio, which means old rag. Straccio Vecchio was the cry of the merchants at the what they call the Porta Portese in Rome, the great flea market, used goods market, and in the 50s it was a treasure chest. It's become just a huge commercial market now. But anyway, another piece of really, in this case, a rather sleazy modulations, you know.
A student of yours, Martin Brody, writes that your music is often about your own imagination in a relentless process of self-discovery. So what have you learned? Who is the self in there? What's this process all about?
I can't answer in words. It's impossible, I think, to answer that. I don't examine myself in those terms. The process of self-discovery is simply the process of uncovering one kind of music or another kind of music. All of it, I think, informed by certain characteristics which are not so much style as a kind of integrity of construction. There's a point in which the composition clarifies and locks things in place.
Yehudi, that sounds more like problem-solving than... self-discovery.
I don't do self-discovery. I don't really know. No, I really don't know what that means. I mean, the process of stumbling on material as I'm working on with the material is an exciting process, sometimes very frustrating. And when it happens and it excites me, then I feel I've hit pay dirt. And I then have to pursue that. I feel very often very frightened at that moment because it's having a tiger by the tail. When you stumble on these thickets of interesting material, you're confronted with the most terrifying task of all, which is somehow living up to it, continuing it, recognizing not only that that nugget is of value, but that nugget has no meaning unless it's in a proper context and unless it's really enveloped in understanding and development.
Take that apart, if you will. I mean, you're talking about developing the meaning of an interval or a rhythm or a combination or a harmony or progression.
How would I continue the idea so that it doesn't just repeat, so that it doesn't just go into sequence? How do I continue it so that it with the material that follows that or precedes it has led up to it in some sort of natural way, organic and natural way? Now, these are all abstract terms. If you want me to show you exactly that, I would love it too if I could do such a thing. I think I can show something of Stracciovecchio. The fact that it begins with this really quite naive and extremely familiar conventional trope. You know, everybody... There's a certain amount of gospel in that. There's a certain amount of that. And it goes on sometimes developing that material so that instead of just letting it go as just that short fragment, it develops it into realms that are not quite expected. We've entered through the same practice and the same kind of motivic development, we've entered into a very different, much less purely vernacular, much less popular realm. It's much more private. There's a purity to it. This has a very clean and spiritual dimension. And then the nostalgia. How does one explain, for example, the fact that in the human being, the cells are all the same? How is it that this is a hand and that's a nose? It's the same stuff that makes it. As a composer, I would love to be able to create something that is that varied and that, at the same time, that organically connected. The guy who does it and who really comes closest to mirroring the processes of nature is Bach. Mm-hmm. Again, the cellular structure is of an integrity and a consistency that's beyond anybody. Mm-hmm. And yet, the surface is infinitely varied.
Yehudi Weiner, would you help us hear your Pulitzer piece, your Grammy-nominated Chiavi in Mano,
right.
Keys in hand, whether it's piano keys or car keys, I'm never quite clear.
Right.
But help us listen. Concerto in one movement, and a real contest with your pal Robert Levin sort of fighting your fight at the keyboard.
Yeah.
Help us hear it.
Well, first, Robert Levin doesn't fight fights. He fights skirmishes. For what the rest of us would be full course battles with tanks and bombs and God knows what is, for Bob, just a war game fought with dull bayonets.
He has the ball from beginning to end, a solo at the beginning,
yeah.
And then a kind of contest with winds, I think, and then ending with a big boogie-woogie finale.
Yes, yeah.
Tell us about that piece, and then okay. I'll tell you how I hear it.
The piece begins with a quote from the piece that I had finished previously called Commedia, piece I wrote for Richard Stoltzman and Emmanuel Axe for clarinet and piano. And I don't know why I had the idea that that was material that wasn't really fully developed. And it occurred to me that what was significant to me were these intervals, the major third and the minor third. Now, we know that in the, I don't remember the key, but Also sprach Zarathustra, Strauss. You go from a major to a minor chord. And this is not any different from that, except in a rather flimsy version compared to Strauss's. Anyway, the piece begins with this rather romantic and private peroration. That's the whole introduction of the piece, and it's pure, it's piano alone. So this is just these two things piled up, the minor third and the so-called minor sixth, which is it's the combination of minor third and major third.
Of course, that's not what we're supposed to hear, right?
You don't know, not at all, any more than the 12-tone composers, the great Viennese composers said, you're not supposed to hear the row. You're not supposed to hear. You're not supposed to know and identify the alchemical procedures by which they arrive at what they arrive. That's trade secrets. You're not supposed to, because if you did, it would all become as antiseptic and as explicable as science. Mm-hmm. It's a different medium altogether. So we're constantly trying to disguise the fact that these things are all related, but they... That's still that same minor third, major third. It's right there together. But it has now a different expressive excitement or nuance. The first interruption in this piece... and suddenly the orchestra comes in... What's that? First of all, I've got to say that I had a devil of a time accepting that as the next idea. It didn't enter the picture easily. It broke down the door. Does that match up with the apparent seriousness and gravity and dreaminess of this? It's an intrusion. It's from another world. However, if you take these chords and take them aside from the articulation, which is very lively and frivolous, you take the actual progression. That's the most common progression you find in gospel music. It's all connected with amens, with hallelujahs, and it's also the sort of the so-called plagal cadence, which in classical music for time immemorial has been a religious reference. You find it in Schubert, you find it way before Schubert, you find it in Bach, you find it, you know, it's used as an amen. Now, I don't do this kind of analytical work when I'm working, when I'm writing a piece. But looking back, I realize that what that's made up of is a major third and a minor third. And that's what we had in the very beginning. Over and over again, that kind of thing. Now, there's a section that suddenly where a lot of the motion just stops and it becomes very thoughtful. A passage that I'm very fond of. Solo piano. Okay. It goes through such a number of transformations. And finally, the kicker is something that absolutely astonished me. There are two things. Near the end, you get the brass going. There's something very grave, not tragic, but very serious about that. Suddenly the piano at the end comes in with... etc. Well, all the boogie-woogie does is simply to rhythmatize that same progression of two chords. And above that is material we've had before. And that material now is, again, it's the minor thirds, the major third, but it's based on... Those are tropes that one finds constantly played in all the way back to Chicago, Dixieland, almost anything, to rags. And what happens, in my opinion, is that this, because of its position, it achieves a kind of exultancy, an affirmation that its reference, its presence in popular music sort of implies, but here it's made just blatant. It gets into a kind of ecstatic, almost Beethoven-like excitement. Hmm. And then... You know, it signs off with a smile rather than a serious, taking it seriously. Not a Beethoven-type ending.
On my umpty-umpth listening, I suddenly heard Rhapsody in Blue sort of almost a century later. Mm-hmm. A rhapsody in a darker, more difficult, more dissonant blue, but very much that kind of clash of elements in a vernacular and ultimately in a big celebratory sound.
Right. Well, the celebratory, yes, a great deal. Well, I mean, I revere Gershwin as the greatest potential we ever had. The allusion to Gershwin only does me proud.
In conversations with poets, we asked a lot of them, who do you think of as doppelgangers in another medium? Yehudi Weiner in another skin or another century out there? Really?
Oh, sure.
You don't read a poet or a filmmaker or a novelist or even a musician of another century and say, you know, that's my guy. Well, that's me.
Well, I suppose I do to some extent, but, you know, you want to name 100 composers that I feel I would like to be or that I feel some affinity to, some aspect of them, some corner of what Beethoven did, some corner of what Mozart did, some one three-note phrase of Bach's or Haydn's or Handel's or Monteverdi. Where are we going to go with this thing where all of these people live and all of these people somehow resonate? And I feel I wish, or I feel I share something. I share things with Brahms, for sure. I share things with Debussy, for sure. I think she things with Hindemith and Stravinsky and sometimes Schoenberg and Verg and Webern. I mean, it's just all of them.
Is there a perfect gold standard piece of music out there for you?
No.
I'm thinking of our late great friend Earl Kim, who said Robert Schumann's Traumerei from the Kinderszenen was a perfect piece. And yeah. I went and learned it and actually played it for Earl just to try to get inside his head about it. I asked Earl one time if he'd been sitting on the beach and a piece of paper rolled up with the Traumerei written on it and had no idea whence it came, how long would it take him to see that it was a masterpiece? And he said about 5 seconds.
Well, he was very, very swift guy. He was very quick.
Do you have Traumerei in your hands?
No, I don't.
That's the one.
If you want to say, are there 1,000 pieces from the canon that I love beyond description and can find no fault with, I would say yes.
Hmm.
But I do not feel there is one. There is a little piece I would like to play for you that is like a shining jewel.
Please.
It's very short, and most people don't know it. It goes like this.
I give up.
Almost nobody knows. The other day I played it for some people and they said Schumann. Another person said Schoenberg. Somebody said you. And I said I should live so long. I should be so lucky. Well, the story is very simple. Mozart went to visit the Thomaskirche in Leipzig to come to see some of more of Bach's music. And he was shown in parts Singet im Herrn ein neues Lied, the 8-part motet. And he was reading it from the parts, not from the score, and they said his eyes were spinning. Mm. And then he went back to the guest house and was asked to sign the guest book. He wrote this piece out. The piece that doesn't exist anywhere else. Somehow the collision with Bach at that moment immediately exploded into this little perfect, extraordinary, concentrated meeting of the minds. He met Bach on the same... on the same field of combat.
Isn't that amazing?
Oh, it's amazing. Chris, I'm a sucker for music. And I love what I'm hearing. I mean, I'm listening, I'm learning, and I am evaluating, you know, but at a certain point where the music gets to a certain level of excellence, all the censorship, all the screening, all the comparing just evaporates. I just open my arms and I listen.
Yehuda, give us your report to the ancestors, so to speak, on composition in a decade into the 21st century. What's the state of this art?
It's infinitely varied. I think we have a spectrum of variety in manner and expression and intent that is utterly unprecedented. Musicians are now really actively trying to investigate the interconnection of world art, of world music. They're studying African music and Hindu music and South Indian music and Japanese gagaku and no theater and Chinese folk music. And they're trying sometimes these efforts of imitation or of reference result in a collage merely a kind of pastiche. In other cases, there is a real effort and a successful effort to synthesize in a new expression a lot of the various influences. But there are things which are being very, very widely practiced in contemporary music which I find very alien, really very alien and incomprehensible to me, even music by some of my former students. But I find that they are espousing values in their writing that I don't understand.
Meaning what? Values?
Meaning I don't understand their sense of line, melodic line. I don't begin to understand what I feel is an absence of nuanced harmony, expressive harmony. I don't understand the masses of the balances of things, the coherence of order, of how things progress, of how things develop. I don't understand their processes of development. Mm. I find the emphasis is almost heavily weighted in the realm of texture and orchestration and color. And those are values to me which are very low on the value and the value list.
Interesting.
And very troubling. Because, you know, it's inescapable for any conscious person to look back and say, well, the time has come. I'm the old fogey now. In my time, things were good.
For vast numbers of people, it's a Bono and Beyonce world.
Yes, it is. I can attest to that from having just been at the Grammys 2 weeks ago. And one of the things that I came to the conclusion about was that there is very little affirmative music in contemporary American music and has not been for the last 50 years because what passes as affirmative is really rather imperial and militaristic. It all comes from a kind of big band, marching band society and kind of music, and it blares and it proclaims, but it doesn't really affirm. And it ascribes to the affirmation that Beethoven would have, but fails all the time because it's very superficial and aggressive. And that applies even to the music of people we admire, like Copland and others. But it occurred to me, with all the jazz references in Chiavi in Mano, that that's where the true affirmation of American music is. It's in popular music. It's in jazz. Mm. It's in gospel.
Interesting.
And there, that music is so self-sufficient and never proclaims its affect or its message. It just is the message. And that is, I think, I was just lucky enough by intuition to capture some aspect of that in Chiavi in Mano. And I thought I was a lucky guy.
You are a lucky guy. I'm thinking also, though, of Alex Ross's book, The Rest Is Noise, in which he sums up in a kind of ambiguous way that for many people, composition at the end of the 20th century had veered toward oblivion, that it was almost over. From another standpoint, it's fanning out into all kinds of niches in the world, but in small halls even around this country. I mean, what's your net sense of the progress of things?
It depends what day you ask me that question. Some days I'm in despair thinking that indeed the oblivion is the rule. And having come back from that Grammy experience, I came back really quite devastated.
Tell me.
Well, I came back feeling that the music that is being promulgated, that is being produced, and most widespread in its broadcast is music which is aggressive, very shiny, very egocentric, very repetitive, and noisy, busy, and in some ways mindless. It's very physical.
Mm.
And the problem with that is not that that music exists, it's that that music has inundated our culture and our youth. So that when you finish being conditioned by that music, there's very little capability of any kind of other sensibility. You're no longer sensitive to things that move at a slower pace, things that are nuanced, things that have complication, and things that have lots of reference to the past. And at the same time, we look at many other factors. We see the number of concerts. We see the number of really gifted people entering and sticking with their musical education at the conservatories and going out into the world, and they're not all immediately becoming businessmen and advertisers, right, and entering the pops, but they are persisting and in many cases starting with trying to reinvent the way music is presented. And you see these articles day after day about the Poisson, whatever it's called, in New York, this club where people are performing all kinds of music, serious music. They're mixing and matching. They're doing pop music. They're doing guitar music. And they're doing complicated things by Stockhausen and Carter and God knows what. And, you know, in some way, there is some hope in the sheer number of gifted people who are committed to music making, pursuing what they really love. Mm. What does that mean? Well, it means there is somewhere in their psyche either a compulsion to do something against the grain or a perception that there is a possibility of an interesting life for them.
If they asked you, Yehudi, what would you tell them?
They ask me tomorrow. I would say, I don't know. I would say, listen, there's only one thing that's important, and that is the texture of every day. If this is the kind of thing that makes you happy, then if you sit at a desk and make $1 million, you're not going to have a life worth living. That's what I would say. You do what you, it's the old thing, follow your bliss, you do what you love, do what you're committed to, regardless of the consequences.
What is the chance, Yehudi Weiner, that composers' music will have the public ear again? Even in the fashion of Aaron Copland, say?
I think for the foreseeable future, the chances are very slim. But, you know, in the long term, things change. Certain cultures collapse and others come up. The convention of the concert hall and the function of concert music and art music is not a permanent given. The audience is certainly shrinking and certainly aging. Those things are incontrovertible. The thing that persuades us that there are possibilities for other things, there are other possibilities for the future, is the ubiquitous presence of music. People have it on their iTunes. They have it constantly at their beck and call. And this thing, the phenomenon I alluded to about all these graduate students, people coming out of schools and really forming small groups here and there and somehow keeping the art alive, perhaps as the monks kept ancient art alive in the monasteries in isolation during the Middle Ages. But I think for the foreseeable future, there is no possibility for an Igor Stravinsky or a Shostakovich or an Aaron Copland, or even an Ives on the general public screen.
Thank you, Yehudi Weiner, for letting us into this sanctuary, letting us into your head, letting us track the music, among other things, to the rotation of your hands and see it and hear it. Thank you, Yehudi Weiner.
Well, thanks, Chris. As a composer who's lived in isolation in many ways all his life, I'm grateful for anybody who wants in.
That's Addio Roma, Yehudi Weiner's own farewell to Rome that he was playing as we left his studio. Paul McCarthy recorded and edited this conversation. We have in mind further glimpses into lives in many kinds of music. Suggest people and angles, please. Leave your comments and learn more about Yehudi Weiner at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.